Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, you can click on Here We Still Stand, not the live stream that a bunch of you already did. I'm talking about Here We Still Stand next year. It's going to be live and in person one way or another. That's what we're talking about. You can register for that event and get that early bird pricing for $149. You can attend the conference. You get to go to all the sessions. It takes care of all your food, all your drink. You get to pick your breakouts. It's a good time. It's going to be a three-day event next October. Go ahead and get it. Get that ticket now. But also, you might be thinking, man, October, that's like a year away. I don't have to wait a whole year. Well, you don't have to wait a whole year because in April, we're going to be having our first ever regional event, a two-day event in Northwest Arkansas, Bentonville. That's where I happen to live, so I'm familiar with the place. It's going to be awesome. Northwest Arkansas is great in the spring. If you've never been to the Ozarks in the spring, you should check it out. Here's the deal, though. If you're registering for Here We Still Stand, the general conference in October, you'll see an option to bundle that ticket, which is normally $65 for the two-day event. You can get it for $50. So what I'm telling you is that you can register for both the general conference and the regional conference for a grand total of $199. Less than $200, Chad. You can go to both if you do that soon.
Total steal.
Total steal.
Yeah. Both it's a no-brainer. You got to go to both.
Yeah, you got to go to both if you can. Like both of these events are going to be a blast. They're going to be different. So if you're like, I'll just go to one, I get it. No, they're going to be different. If you've been to Here We Still Stand before, you know what kind of big party that is and all the food and hanging out. And you know, it's at a resort. And then the regional event will be a little bit different. We're going to have an actual concert, a first ever concert at one of our events. So Andy Gullihorn, who's one of my personal favorites, is going to be coming down from Nashville to perform on Friday nights. We're having a concert and, I mean, the regular stuff, bunch of hanging out and that kind of stuff as well. But we're going to take over a downtown city square. So it's going to be a good time. So if you can
Did
go
you
to-
say we're taking over the city?
Taking over, no, the square, just the square. We're just taking just over square, the restaurants okay. and the
Getting
and the
my
venue.
Hopes up there. I thought we yeah, were taking, the we're taking control.
No, dude, the venue's cool. I mean, you got to think about like an old school theater, like rock and roll venue kind of thing for this event. It's going to be a good time. So
yeah, you sent me pictures of that, and it looks incredible.
Yeah, it's
really
gonna,
cool inside.
It's going to be cool. It's going to be a cool thing. If you can go to both, you want to go to both. Hey, if you can't, and you live in Texas or you know Kansas City or St. Louis or you know anywhere in the tri-state area, you definitely want to come check out the Northwest Arkansas event. But even if you need to get on a plane, still going to be worth it. You can fly right in here. You can fly 15 minutes from the venue. So. Get that done. You can go over to herewestillstand.org and you can click on which conference you're interested in. But of course, if you register for the main conference in October, you can go to the regional one for just $50 if you want to do that. All right, Chad, we left Saul sitting there, had some misplaced piety. He was told to kill a bunch of stuff. He decided to not kill the best stuff because he was going to sacrifice that to the Lord. In my mind, this is not one of those times where Saul is freaked out to see Samuel. I think initially he's probably like, did what you said.
Yeah, this is really a fascinating chapter. I mean, for lots of reasons. I mean, there's a lot of kind of rhetorical stuff going on behind the scene. Just the way the story, I mean, there's a multiple ways that you could tell the story, right? So yep. The way it's told becomes significant as well. And so you got that going on. You got some pretty heavy theology going on here. I mean, like, just for instance, we didn't quite get to this. In fact, we stopped right at the brink of this verse. But what does it mean for God to regret doing something? Yep. In fact, the Hebrew verb for regret, nacham, is used three times in this chapter. And on the surface, it's sort of used in a contradictory sort of way, because we hear in verse 11 that God regrets making Saul king. And then at the very end of the chapter, verse 35, it said the Lord regretted that he had made Saul king over Israel. And then a few verses earlier, verse 29, we read that the Lord, the God of Israel, the glory of Israel, will not lie or change his mind. Now, in all three of those verses, the verb for regret or change his mind is naham. So which is it? Will he naham or will he not naham? So we're going to have to kind of wrestle with that a little bit. We've actually encountered this in earlier books. We encountered it, the story of the flood.
Yep.
Lord regretted he had made man on the earth. And we encountered it after the episode of the Golden Calf. So we got that to get to. And then we just kind of figure out what's going on here between Saul and Samuel. And I mean, their pretty rocky relationship is going to really, really come to the fore here as we work our way through it. It's a lot of pretty good stuff coming up.
Yeah, I mean, so the God regretting things is tricky. I think that sometimes we can take the sovereignty of God and then apply it in a way that's not helpful, as if sovereignty somehow means that you would be unemotional and have no feeling toward anything that happened because you know all things, right? So if you're omniscient and you're sovereign, well, how could you have any feelings about the way anything happened? Of course, you knew it was going to happen. Not only that, but you have control over it if you want to. Yeah. And so we take this idea of God and we're like, well, God doesn't have any feeling toward things that go on because he could just change what went on if he didn't approve of it or didn't like it. And of course, why would he regret anything? I mean, he knows what the outcome of his decisions are going to be. So why would you ever make any decisions that you would regret? This doesn't seem like something that anyone would do if they were both sovereign and omniscient. Why would you want to do this? But we are not sovereign and omniscient, but there's certain things that we know, Chad, and we still do. This is going to be a very weird example, but it's the one that popped into my head. Have you ever had a pizza and there's one piece left and you know that you shouldn't. You're already full. You're already done. And you know that you should not. But you say, I'm going to regret this later. And then you take that thing and you eat it. Now, in that moment, you're omniscient in this way that you know that you are going to regret that later. You know you are. You've stated it. And it may, in the next day, it comes to pass that you do, in fact, when you wake up, you do have regret, just as you predicted. But this does not stop you from doing it. So this is a poor example, but it's what it means is that, like, you can know things and still do things, and then that thing exactly happens. So God doesn't not know when he calls Saul to be king that he's going to regret it, but he does it anyway for other purposes. Now, they're probably not the same purposes that you and I would maybe eat that piece of pizza. They're different purposes, but you ate it for a reason, and sure enough, you regretted it. And God appoints Saul king for a reason, knowing that he will regret it.
I wish I could not identify as well as I can with your example, but I've experienced that on multiple occasions, and it's actually a great example, and it's a great, this is a, in my mind, a good example of how necessary it is to have both, I guess, what you would call a good biblical basis for describing how God acts with his people, and at the same time, a good theology, a good, maybe a systematic theology, because these two work in tandem. So that, I mean, if you're just kind of a systematic theologian and you're dealing with the sovereignty of God and the omniscience of God, and you're just speaking in those categories, and you encounter something like this, well, then it's easy to kind of dismiss this, right? Oh, this is just kind of an anthropomorphism. This is just kind of ascribing human qualities to God. But I think if you hold these both in tension and see how they interact well with each other, then that's the best way forward.
Yeah, and I actually like texts like this because it personalizes God. God is not unpersonal. He's not even unperson, right? So he is a God who actually does feel things. This God does regret things. He gets angry. He gets sad, which all means that he is also capable of the thing that he says the most about himself, which is love. So if you want a God who is love and who feels love and compassion and passion towards sinners or anybody else, these verses tell you that he is capable of such a feeling because he is capable of feeling, period.
Yeah, I would much rather have a God like this than kind of a cold, aloof, deistic kind of God who shows no emotion, has absolutely no human-like qualities, and it is sort of the, you know, generic, great, cold power out there in the universe.
Yeah.
Give me the God of the Bible over that any day.
Yeah, you don't, no, that's not the God you want at all. And, you know, it's also this regret kind of language. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but when I read it, it's like a remorse or a sadness that is baked in there. When God, in the case of the flood, this seems that this is that God is both angry and sad, that he is hurt, right?
Yeah.
And I think that we understand what this is like. There's certain things that we know, we both know that unless something terrible happens, that our parents will die, you know, before us. Now I know that, at some point, that most people bury their parents. This does not make that day easier just because you know it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the actual day comes to pass at some point. When that day comes to pass, it hurts, and it hurts no less because you knew it was coming. I think that's the same for God, that God knows certain days are coming, certain things, events will come to pass. He knows all things, and in some essence is in all places, but still those things happen in a place and time at some point, and it doesn't, any more than it does for us, it doesn't make it necessarily easier.
Yeah, yeah. When we've been talking, it reminded me that, actually, I wrote about this this verb, nacham, in Unveiling Mercy. I can't remember, in connection with the flood, maybe. But anyway, I think the analogy that I use there with regard to, you know, how to translate it, how do you be sorry or regret or what, was I think I used the analogy of parents, you know, if they have a child that really goes astray. I mean, they just ends up down a really bad path. They regret that. They don't regret having the child, of course. They just feel sorry. They feel regret because of the decisions that their child has made, and because they actually love their child and want the best. And it's some way like that with our father. I mean, he regrets that humanity has gone the way that they have, but that doesn't alter what he actually desires for humanity.
Yeah, and the
turn from the way and live.
Yeah, and I know we haven't even gotten to the text yet, but a lot of this is this first line of this is that God is going to say that he regrets making Saul king. I also, when the case of Saul, I wonder, I won't say that this is the case, but I wonder if, as things are playing out, is if God is like, it would have been better for Saul if I had not made him king. That I regret making him king because it hasn't went well for him. So it hasn't been personally good for him. It didn't turn out great for the people either. And so I don't think that it's completely removed from God's feelings towards Saul, that this was, that he, as we've said before, that he is ill-suited for this position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you almost see that kind of compassion, I guess, increase as Saul just unravels, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this what we've seen so far is nothing compared to what's going to happen to him in subsequent chapters. So, yeah, it's gonna be a rough road for Saul from here on out. Well, it already has been, but it's going to get even rougher.
Well, I guess 15 minutes into the podcast, we should get into the text.
I guess we should. Yeah. I mean, we really have kind of been covering the territory, because in some ways this particular discussion covers the whole rest of the chapter, because we have three occurrences of this particular verb. Okay. So verse 10, the word of the Lord comes to Samuel. Now, Samuel has not been part of the story so far, right? Except sending Saul on this mission. That's how the chapter starts out. Samuel says to Saul that he is to go and strike down Amalek. So he appears there, and now he's going to reappear when the word of the Lord comes to him and says, I regret that I've made Saul king. Why? Because he's turned back from following me and has not carried out my commands. So in the plural there, commands. Now, I'm not sure exactly how to translate the rest of this verse. My translation, New American Standard, has, and Saul was distressed and cried out to the Lord all night. Now, In the ESV, it says Samuel was angry and he cried to the Lord all night. Now, this is pretty fascinating with regard to Samuel's approach or reaction to this word from the Lord. We've talked both on and off the podcast about Samuel and Saul's kind of back and forth relationship. And at times, Samuel almost seems to have a sort of, maybe jealousy isn't the right word, but he seems to be disappointed that the people, as it were, rejected him and wanted a king instead. And then at other times, he seems complimentary toward Saul, even really in a way adopting him as his son. And then at other times, he almost seems to react with vehemence and anger at Saul for what he's done. Now, what's interesting about this particular passage is because the Hebrew does have the Hebrew verb is angry. So I don't think distress is the best way to translate this. So Samuel's angry, but the real question is
with who?
Yeah. I mean, it's obvious what he's angry about. He's angry because of the whole situation here that now has been created by Saul. But God says, I regret that I've made Saul king, hasn't carried out my commands, and Samuel is angry. So is he angry at Saul? Is he angry at God? Is he angry at both of them? Is this kind of this general anger toward everything that's going on? It's a little difficult to tell, although I will say this, and this was surprising to me. It's kind of a technical Hebrew point of grammar, but the way this sentence is constructed, we have other parallels to this. And the other parallels seem to suggest that Samuel's actually mad at God here.
Yeah, it seems to me that he is. Now, this is Samuel's a man who is, I think, that cares deeply for the people of Israel. And when God said, "Hey, they've asked for a king," Samuel knows it's a bad idea. And then God's going to give him what they want, and he points Samuel towards Saul. So Samuel doesn't like this, but God says, hey, don't worry about it. They haven't rejected you. They've rejected me. Now Samuel's like not totally buying that argument. He thinks that he's not saying that they haven't rejected God, but it sort of feels like a little bit like they've rejected both of them.
Feels pretty personal.
Yeah. And I think that makes sense that Samuel will be angry with God as a man who clearly understands what we talked about earlier, which is the omniscience and sovereignty of God. That when God comes along and says, I regret that I have appointed Saul king, Samuel, of course, I think it's very natural for him to be like, well, what in the heck? I mean, like,
why
did you pick him? Like, and also, I'm the one who had to anoint him. This looks terrible. Like, if he's terrible, this doesn't look exactly great for me. Like, I picked the wrong guy or something. So I can see Samuel being not really angry with Saul, but him going right to who he thinks. He doesn't think, he's like, look, because we've said 100 times now, Saul didn't ask for this job. He didn't campaign for this position. So Samuel knows where to place the blame as far as, look, you picked this guy. Like, he didn't show up at my doorstep saying, I'd like to be king now. You told me. And so Samuel, in some ways, is, I think, right. And if you're going to be angry, he's pointing the anger in the right direction. That look, yeah. You're the one that knows all things. You're the one who appointed him. If this is not going well, the people are probably going to point the finger at me. But that ain't where it should be pointed.
Yeah, and I'm glad you said what you did too. About I mean, he knows the direction to point, right? And not only does that, but I was thinking about this situation in comparison to one of the other situations where the same kind of Hebrew grammar is used, and that's way back in Genesis 4. So when Cain is angry because the Lord doesn't accept a sacrifice, the same kind of language is used there. But contrast these two situations. So Cain is angry at God, obviously, but he doesn't say a word to God. Now, in this situation, Samuel is also angry at God. And how does he respond? It says he cried out to the Lord all night. Now, what's fascinating is the verb for cry out is the same word that's used back in Genesis 4 for how the blood of Abel was crying out to the Lord. So rather than Cain being angry and actually crying out to God, instead he lashed out at his brother, and the blood of that brother ended up doing the lamenting, ended up doing the crying out. So my point is that when we are angry with God, either for what we think are good reasons or maybe for what end up being bad reasons, whatever the situation might be, the best thing we can do is actually turn to God with that anger and cry out to him rather than lashing out at someone else, which tends to be what we do. Okay, so we kind of got the groundwork laid. Let's see what happens. It does seem as if Samuel is still pretty upset as the story goes on. He gets up early, goes out to meet Saul, and they tell Samuel that Saul came to Carmel, and behold, he set up a monument for himself, and then he turned and proceeded on down to Gilgal. That's an odd detail, by the way. He set up a monument for himself.
Yeah, it's like, he built a statue of himself. Like, that's a great thing I did here.
I suppose so. Yeah, it's actually the Hebrew there is yad, which is the word for hand. It usually just actually does mean that hand, but I guess it has a few isolated occurrences where it has this meaning of a monument. Some almost get the image of, like, you know, somebody holding their arm up and waving their hand, like, "Hey, look at me, look what I did." It's kind of the idea here behind using that word for a monument.
It sort of leads you to believe even more that Saul does not see what's coming, because he's probably feeling pretty. He must be feeling pretty good about the way things have gone.
Yeah, I mean, every time I set up a monument for myself, it's usually because I'm proud of myself.
Yeah. build a little statue. Be like, this is a really, really great thing I've done. I think that everyone would agree, so much so that I could, you know, build this thing right here. I think that this shows you that, yeah, this is going to be a bummer for Saul, because I don't think he sees this. I don't think he sees this coming.
No, and you can tell that from the next verse when Samuel shows up, and Saul goes out to meet him, and he's just like bubbling over with enthusiasm. He says, "Blessed are you of the Lord. I have carried out the command of the Lord."
Which is exactly what the Lord said that he had not done.
Yeah.
But we're doing a lot of morals in these stories, but they're kind of weird morals. These morals are things not to do that you might be inclined to do. Don't make oaths. Don't say that you'll kill people that are important to you if certain things aren't carried out. Also, I don't think it's ever good to go up to someone and say, "I have carried out the commandments of the Lord." This is not a wise thing to say.
Yeah, as a good rule of thumb, never say that.
Let someone else tell you that you've carried out the commands of the Lord. Let another lips praise you for the commandments that you've kept.
There you go. That's proverbial right there. All right. So Samuel's response is classic. I mean, I think Saul expects Samuel to say, you know, "Well done, good and faithful servant." And instead we have this, and this is just dripping with sarcasm. Samuel says, "Oh yeah, what then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear?" I mean, of all the ways to respond, I mean, it's certainly memorable, right? "Oh yeah, you see, you've carried out the command of the Lord. What's up with all this animal noise I hear?"
Yes.
If you carried it out, there wouldn't be any sheep left to bleat or any oxen left to be making whatever noise oxen make. Samuel's accusation is rather creative, or his counter to Saul's claim is pretty creative. Yeah. So he's going to defend himself, right? Or go ahead.
Well, I don't even know. Yeah, well, you say, yeah, I don't even know if he's defending himself as much as I think at this point he still thinks this is just an explanation. It's I don't even know if he's in need of thinking at this point he's in need of a defense.
Yeah. So he says, my people have brought the animals from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, but the rest we have utterly destroyed.
Yeah. Now the one hint, I might be, so the and I do think it's interesting that he does this. in his reply, he does make this thing where he refers to the Lord as Samuel's God.
Yeah.
Right. So he might have an inkling that Samuel's maybe it's probably written on Samuel's face that he's a little irritated. I mean, he has been up all night fighting with God, and so Saul's like, "All right, look, I'm gonna make some sacrifices to your God with these animals. This is a good idea." But it is interesting that he doesn't say, "My God," our God," or just the Lord God.
Right. There's a subtle shift too, and I don't know if we want to read too much into this, but with regard to the subjects, because back in verse 9. It says, but Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and the oxen and so forth. Now, in Saul's response, he says, for the people spared the best of the sheep
oxen. A little bit of an Adam move there.
Yeah, it's a little bit of an Adam
these people,
shift
you,
of responsibility here.
It's these people the Lord gave me to rule over.
Right, yeah. So that's why I find this chapter so fascinating, because you're constantly, from verse to verse, you're trying to guess kind of what's going on in everybody's mind. And, you know, is this a straightforward answer? Is he kind of sidestepping responsibility a little bit here? What's happening?
Well, Samuel's about to tell him to shut up in Hebrew.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. In fact, I don't like the New American Standard translation. They say, wait. And the ESV has stop, but I think shut up would be a much better translation. So he says to him, basically, just stop talking, shut up, because I've got something to say to you. Let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night. And Saul responds, speak. All right, yeah, let's have it. So Samuel says, he's got this long speech that he's about to deliver. Samuel says, isn't it true that though you were little in your own eyes, you were made the head of the tribes of Israel, and the Lord anointed you king over Israel, and the Lord sent you on a mission and said, go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are exterminated. Why then, by this point, you know that Saul is getting nervous. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord, but rushed upon the spoil and did what was evil in the sight of the Lord? So there's some kind of interesting additions here. First of all, when he is talking about the mission, he says, he adds the sinners. In the original commission, he just says, hey, go and utterly destroy the Amalekites. Mm-hmm. But it's as if Samuel wants to make sure that we know how bad the Amalekites are. So he throws in the sinners. And then the verse 19, he says, why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord, but rushed upon the spoil? That verb in Hebrew has this idea of almost like a predator would pounce upon the prey, something like that.
Yeah, actually, the ESV actually translates that as pounce.
Yeah, that's a good translation. There's actually no record of that happening, about them pouncing upon the prey. So I'm not sure if that is just Samuel sort of hamming this up, you know, kind of just maybe engaging a little bit of hyperbole to make his point, or what it is. But I mean, the overall message, of course, is clear. He says, listen, we all know how you started, right? You were little in your own eyes, but God chose you. He made you the king. He sent you on this mission. He gave you a clear command. Go and utterly wipe them out until they are exterminated. So, based upon all that, why did you act the way you did? Why didn't you obey the voice of the Lord, but instead ended up doing what was evil in the sight of the Lord?
You know, one thing that's interesting about the way he starts too, and you can tell me this translation work is wrong here, but it seems to me that he says, not even that though you were little or small, but though you are little in your own eyes, are you not the head of the tribes of Israel? It seems that there's two things going on there, that Saul still doesn't think too much of himself. So there's not this like huge arrogance in Saul, that this seems like a current thing, that though you are little in your own eyes, are you not the head of the tribes of Israel? And then also that when he shifts over and says, oh yeah, the people went and did this thing, that maybe Samuel is saying, look, I know in your own eyes that you don't view yourself as like some sort of leader of men, but you are in fact the head of the tribes of Israel. So whatever they do falls on you, regardless of how you view yourself.
Yeah. That's a great point. And when you were talking, I was looking at the Hebrew there. It's one of these situations where it could be translated as past or present. It's kind of a verbless sort of sentence. So yeah, I mean, and I think it makes sense. You know, it doesn't matter if you translate it past or present. That does seem to be the way in which Saul views himself, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't matter how you look at yourself, this is your vocation to which God has called you.
Yeah, you could say like, well, the people were, they rushed it. What was I going to do? Well, you're the king, so you were going to stop him. That's what you were going to do.
Buck stops with you. Okay, so he's got a response. Saul said to Samuel, I did obey the voice of the Lord and went on the mission on which the Lord sent me and have brought back Agag, the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people, here we have this possible blame shifting again, but the people took some of the spoil, sheep and oxen, the choicest of the things devoted to destruction, to sacrifice to the Lord your God at Gilgal.
He just basically repeats the whole thing. Like, maybe you didn't hear me the first time. Like, I go check out the Amalekites. You'll see there's just a heap of flame and ash there. Okay. And then the people took this stuff, as I already said, to sacrifice to the Lord your God. Just making myself clear here, just repeating the exact same thing. You're getting old, Samuel. I don't know if you're going deaf, but I already explained exactly what happened. Go check out the Amalekites. Go take a look at what's going on over there.
Yeah. In case you didn't hear me right the first time, I'm gonna say it again. And Samuel goes on to make it clear that, oh yeah, I heard you. Now let me deliver you a kind of a stock prophetic sermon. This is, when I say stock prophetic sermon, it's because we hear this kind of language repeatedly in the later prophets, especially in, well, Isaiah has it, Jeremiah has it, Hosea has it. I expect that the people heard this quite frequently from prophets. So here's how it goes. Has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of divination, and insubordination is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king.
I really like the way that the ESV translates verse 23, which is, for rebellion is as the sin of divination, and presumption is as iniquity and idolatry. Basically, this sort of misplaced piety that we've talked about is being addressed there, where you presumed that God would really dig it if you like kept this stuff to sacrifice for him. But you should never presume that God wants you to do something other than what he's told you to do.
Yeah.
No matter how good or pious you think it is.
Yeah. This whole subject came up quite a bit during the Reformation, right? We have all sorts of piety, which was not commanded by God, all sorts of religious practices, which were not commanded by God, which were in the end deemed to be of even greater value than the things which God himself had commanded, right?
Yeah.
And this does seem to be the way in which humanity works, where we tend to create our own kind of piety, our own religious practices, and elevate those as if they are actually superior to that which God himself has said, or which God himself has given. So let's keep moving so we can wrap up this chapter.
This part is sort of heartbreaking.
You mean what's coming up?
Yeah.
Oh, I was reading through this morning and I thought the exact same thing. I thought, man, this is brutal. So Saul says to Samuel, I've sinned. Just complete confession. I have sinned. I have indeed transgressed the command of the Lord and your words, because I feared the people and listened to their voice. Now, therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me that I may worship the Lord.
This seems pretty good.
Pretty good confession. Yeah. Yeah. So you would think that the response would be, I forgive you.
This guy is asking. This man is asking for the absolution, is he not?
Yeah, he is. Yeah, but he doesn't get it. At least not yet. Samuel says to him, he almost ignores the request for forgiveness. He says, "I will not return with you, because you have rejected the word of the Lord, for the Lord and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel." So Samuel turns to go, and Saul reaches out and grabs the edge of his robe and tore it. And Samuel, taking advantage of that opportunity, uses it as a prophetic sign. He says, "The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to your neighbor who is better than you." And here we have the verse I referred to earlier. "And also, the glory of Israel will not lie or regret or change his mind. He is not a man that he should change his mind." So it doesn't look good for Saul at all. Not only has Samuel seemingly withheld forgiveness, but he's taken this opportunity to kind of double down on not just the threat, but now the pronouncement that it's over, that the kingship is being completely taken away from him.
This is rough. Saul seems pretty desperate. I mean, you at least in my mind, this ripping his robe is not something done in anger, but almost him desperately trying to grab a hold of him to make him stay. And then you have this weird regret language again, where like, hey, the glory of Israel, this is God, of course. He's not like a man where he would have regret. And you're like, what are you talking about? Like, it's just said that he regretted making Saul king. Now, what this shows you is that God, of course, does regret things in a similar way that we regret things, but not in the exact same way that we regret things because of who he is. And so this God who is able to make all things work together for good doesn't regret the way that we regret. Because when we regret, we do not possess the power to shape things to our will. And so when we regret, we're just left with that. When God regrets doing something, he then shapes and molds this thing into the thing that he is ultimately planning.
Yeah, and I do think that's the main point of verse 29, is that it's not that he doesn't change his mind or regret, because obviously he does. I mean, we have multiple instances of this, but he doesn't do so in the way that we do, mm-hmm. right? I mean, we're here today and gone tomorrow, and between today and tomorrow, we make a lot of regrettable decisions. We change our mind all the time. We're fickle. We're arbitrary. But in fact, the very word that's used here for the glory of Israel, as my translation has it, also means in many contexts, everlasting. So it's kind of an accent on God's yesterday, today, and tomorrow being the same. So he's the God who isn't temporal, isn't constantly shifting like we are, but instead he's the eternal one who, when he regrets, it's not the kind of human regret that we are accustomed to.
Yeah, I think maybe a way to think about this, you know, Jesus weeps when he hears about Lazarus, so he weeps like we do, but yet doesn't weep exactly like we do, because he knows about the resurrection, and he knows what he's going to do. I bring them up all the time. The best Christian hardcore band of all time. They have a song about Lazarus, and it says that Jesus had tears on his cheeks and resurrection on his lips. Therefore, he doesn't weep exactly the same way that we do. He does weep, and he does feel sadness, but he knows things that we don't know, and he has power that we don't have.
Yeah, amen. That's perfect.
And perfect. You know what? We're not going to finish this chapter, Chad, because we're going to have to leave a very violent reaction to this whole thing for next week. But guys, if you would like to come hang out with us in April in Northwest Arkansas and or San Diego in October, make sure you go to herewestillstand.org. You can check out all the conference info there, or just go to the website and click on the events. Chad, I will see you next week, where we will in fact finish chapter 15.
Yeah. All right. We'll see you then.